Dirty Moderates, Ronald Reagan left office 35 years ago, and his legacy remains one that has been deeply analyzed, contested, celebrated, reviled, revered. But really understanding, especially at this moment in our history, the importance of somebody who assumed leadership on the, not just the American stage, but the global stage, and took a kind of nuanced statecraft, as I call it, to another level, I think is a key point of Reagan's legacy. Left-wing ideologues be damned. My guest today, I believe, has written the definitive account of Reagan's Cold War era presidency and the challenges that he faced at that time. William Inboden is here. Will, as we're going to call him, is the professor and director of the Hamilton Center of Classical and Civic Education at the University of Florida. Yeah, he worked in the State Department and the National Security Council. And his latest book is The Peacemaker, Ronald Reagan, the Cold War, and the World on the Brink. Will, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Adam. It's great to be with you.
So I actually want to start with a paragraph in the introduction of your book, which I think will get us going and get and as part of our look into this. So you write in the intro, along with Franklin Roosevelt, Ronald Reagan was one of the two most consequential presidents of the 20th century. He was reviled and ridiculed by many experts and pundits at the time, but history's unfolding now offers a new window to reassess him, particularly his foreign policy. His critics, who were legion, feared that his presidency would lead to a disastrous outcomes such as nuclear apocalypse, another Vietnam, quote unquote, and America's terminal decline. Instead, with the peaceful end of the Cold War, collapse of the Soviet Union, renewal of the United States, and global expansion of freedom and prosperity, Reagan's grand strategy succeeded beyond even his imagining. Let's start with that. Let's do an overview before we get into the nitty gritty of why his Cold War legacy ended up being so impactful for where we are today.
Yeah. So, no, thank you, Adam. And I'm so honored to be here and really appreciate the chance to talk about this book and the Reagan legacy, especially during our, let's say, you know, troubled times today. And I do think it's important to begin at the beginning, as you mentioned, which is appreciating what a difficult hand Reagan inherited when he's elected in November of 1980 and then, you know, sworn in, takes the oath of office in January of 81. And just to recap some of the highlights of, or maybe lowlights of what our country had gone through. So it's just a few years after the first lost war in our nation's history, right? The Vietnam War, our withdrawal in disgrace, and then the fall of, you know, South Vietnam to communism. You've got an underfunded and demoralized military as a consequence. The American economy is still a mess, right? I mean, neither President Ford or President Carter had been able to navigate the phenomenon of stagflation, of, you know, high inflation and high unemployment. Of course, you had the energy crisis of the 1970s, you know, the hours-long lines at filling stations, people couldn't even fill up their cars, there wasn't enough gas. You had the Iran hostage crisis, you know, another humiliation for our country of, you know, 50-some American diplomats and spies and soldiers held hostage for, you know, almost a year and a half by after the Iranian revolution. And then if you were to do an overall, you know, kind of score tally or scoreboard in the Cold War in 1980, everyone would say the Soviet Union was winning and the United States was losing, right? The Soviet Union was near the apex of its military might. They had supported successful communist revolutions on almost every continent. So just to rattle off a few, so at Angola, Mozambique, Ethiopia, Nicaragua, Cambodia, Laos, South Vietnam, Afghanistan, South Yemen had all fallen to communism in the last 8 years. And so there really was a sense the United States is in decline. We're divided and demoralized at home. The Soviet Union is winning the Cold War. And then finally, this is often underappreciated. A lot of people thought that the American presidency itself was broken, that this institution was broken, that this job was just too big for one man. And if we use as a general rule of thumb that a successful president is one who can complete two terms, right? There's more to it than that, but let's take that. The last two-term president had been Dwight Eisenhower 20 years earlier. Hmm. And the next five presidents, Reagan's five predecessors, hadn't completed two terms, right? So Kennedy had been felled by an assassin's bullet. LBJ had been driven from office, didn't run for re-election over Vietnam. Nixon resigned over Watergate. Ford had been, you know, appointed after Nixon and then had been defeated by Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter had been defeated by Reagan. So it was just a really almost overwhelming set of challenges for our government, for our role in the world, for our country at home. And when we look back and, you know, want to judge the Reagan record overall, I think you've got to start with asking what kind of hand was he dealt? And it's a very difficult one.
Yeah. I think one of the things that Reagan did so well was took his role as the great communicator, which he was called, projected a kind of sunny conservatism, which sadly seems to have gone into the dustbin, sadly, you know, a Republican Party now that's gone deeply angry populist. You can even argue kind of like weirdly left-wing populist, although under kind of a false conservative guise, because again, they're ideologically incoherent. Mm-hmm. Reagan took something that he believed and thought he could make a policy distinction from his predecessors. And here's what I mean. You know, unlike every Cold War president, which I think is very interesting, and I think your book brings this out very well, and I want to talk about it. We have a policy of containment that began with Harry Truman. But containment, implicit in that, was that the Soviet Union was going to be a fixture. It was going to be here for a long time, right? It was not going anywhere, and we had to therefore contain it. Ronald Reagan came to office and said, no, this is a battle of ideas. This is a battle of civilization, but that battle comes from the idea that communism is inherently evil, and the Soviet Union should be sent what he called, I think, to the ash heap of history. Mm-hmm. Talk about how, you know, the arrival of Reagan on the world stage when he's elected in 1980, how that changes. Because even Republican predecessors, even like Nixon especially, was Mr. Détente. Yeah. You know, and I'm a fan of Nixon foreign policy, but it was, you know, a much more accommodating, you know, deal-making, though Reagan, of course, becomes the ultimate diplomat, which is amazing too. Yeah. But explain that was a huge change in the way that our president would see the world. And I'm sure it, you know, rankled experts and State Department types and all those people everywhere, you know.
Yeah, no, it really did. And again, you're right. This is a very important theme for the book. And the way I summarize it is Reagan had a very different theory of the case in the Cold War than all of his predecessors, right? So this is not a partisan comment. You know, all of his predecessors, Democrats and Republicans, had more or less seen the Cold War the same way, which is that it's this great power rivalry, you know, the great power just meaning a country with a large military and large economy. So the Soviet Union is a great power, it has those, and the United States is a great power, it has those. So it's a great power rivalry that happens to be a contest of ideas. You know, they're communist and we're democratic capitalist. But from that, every previous Cold War president had seen the Soviet Union as a rival to be contained. So you have to coexist with it. There's no possibility of it going away. It certainly can't be defeated, but we just want to contain its further expansion. And Reagan reverses that. Reagan has a very different theory of the case in the Cold War. He sees it as fundamentally a contest of ideas between, you know, the free world, a free society, and communist totalitarianism. So he starts with that, framing it as a battle of ideas that happens to also be a great power contest. But from that, he believed that the Soviet Union was not a permanent fixture on the geopolitical landscape, that this was, you know, even though the Soviet Union had been around for what, you know, 6-7 decades at that point, most experts thought it'll be around for another century. Reagan didn't believe that. He thought that it was actually vulnerable and weak because it was built on these false and broken ideas, that is built on this house of lies, if you will. And looking back in hindsight, I think we can say that he gets that theory of the case right. And, you know, the results speak for themselves, but it's extremely controversial at the time. Most, you know, academic experts, most foreign policy experts in his party, as well as in the Democratic Party, thought this is nuts. You know, the Soviet Union is, you know, strong and durable, and they've been around forever, and they're going to be around forever, and we just need to manage them. And Reagan believed very differently. But that brings to one other point you had started with, it's really important, is him as a great communicator. So because he believes in the power of ideas, because he believes in the the power of the American idea because he believes in the falsehood of the communist idea. He wanted to communicate that to the American people in the world. And so he took that, the communication part of the job, very seriously. He knew that if I'm going to ask the American people and our allies to support a very different, you know, somewhat more risky strategy in the Cold War, I need to explain it to them. I need to bring them along. I need to put it in terms that they can understand, but also that they'll appreciate. And he treated the American people like adults. And so even though he could speak in pretty plain terms, he was still communicating some sophisticated ideas there. And as you said, underneath that was this, this strain of real optimism, right? You know, one way to summarize it is Reagan believed in mourning in America, you know, and Trump's signature line is American carnage, right? I mean, it's just, these are very different beliefs about America and the values of our country.
Yeah. I think also, especially for this generation, our current generation, who seems to think history begins with them. It's a weird kind of narcissism that, you know, that sort of decides what's good and what's bad. I think there's so much junk coming out of academia. It's outrageous. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that there are way too many people. I saw them when I was at grad school at Brown not too long ago, who are like literally just sort of like bereft Marxists or something. They can't quite get over a system that never worked, never could work, and would only lead to totalitarianism is like not there anymore or any really respected. I mean, I guess it's there in some places. And I think it's important to know and to discuss with you what it felt like you said at the beginning, because not only were these countries falling to communism, but America felt really awful about itself.
Yeah.
You know, and we were supposed to be, and had been, especially in the booming post-war years, the exemplar of freedom and prosperity and replacing the British Empire as the leader of the free world, essentially, right? And that despite our problems, we could overcome things. But Vietnam and Watergate put paid to that idea, mm-hmm. like you said, the seizure of the embassy and Tehran, all of that. Ended up being, among other things, a Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, you know, but there is something very spiritual, not religious, about what Reagan did, because he said, we're Americans and we can come back. We can do this again. And I think I say this because we now have a guy who's the head of the Republican Party, or what's left the Republican Party, who says this is a horrible country. It's basically crap. Everything's terrible. Nothing's working. And I can make it better, but we have basically a pessimistic view of the future. If I don't get in there, it's over. Reagan's contagious optimism. And again, I was born in 74, so I'm in the 80s coming up as a kid. I never felt more comfortable than watching, honestly, although I was raised a Democrat, I'm not one anymore. I'm an independent, but I never felt better than watching a Reagan speech. You know, it made you feel we had a leader, made me believe in the country. It I think informed so much of my thinking as a patriot, and I really think that's important too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're exactly right. And we're about the same age. I was born in 1972, so writing this book was kind of revisiting my growing up years as well.
We're little kids of the Cold War.
Yeah, we are. And like you, I was in a family of Democrats, and it's the same thing. So did not grow up with any great strong support or affection for Reagan. But even then, remember watching his speeches on TV, and there's something about this guy, the way he speaks to us and about our country. You realize he really believes this stuff, right? And I mean that as both an observation but also a compliment. I mean, this was not feigned. You can't feign or contrive this for 8 years, especially during some real challenging times for our country.
And if I may interject, for those that don't know, Ronald Reagan was an FDR Democrat.
Yeah.
Who transitioned into a conservative Republican. For those that don't know, Reagan, for so many years before the conservative movement fell into a puddle of hate and rage. Reagan was, in many ways, right, the apotheosis of the conservative icon when it came to presidents, but he was a Democrat.
And I'm glad you bring up the FDR Democrat part, because I believe the first vote he ever cast for president was for FDR. And one source of Reagan's optimism was his sense of history. Remember, so his formative growing up years are during the Depression and World War II.
Yeah.
Very difficult times for our country. But he had seen America overcome even worse, right? The Depression was about as bad as it got, still the worst time in our country economically. Of course, World War II, still, you know, the biggest threat we've, you know, the free world has ever faced of totalitarianism taking over the entire world. And so Reagan had seen America successfully overcome those challenges, you know, be a part of leading the free world, you know, overcoming the Depression, restoring prosperity, and leading the free world to victory in World War II. And he'd seen it done by a very inspiring, great communicator of a president in FDR. And so part of Reagan, the source of Reagan's optimism and communications priorities as president, you know, 40, 50 years later, is his own sense of history. He's thinking, he often refers to it. Our country has gotten through this stuff before. I believe in American ideals. I believe in the American system, not just as a set of abstractions, but as something that has succeeded in history before, and we can do it again. And so that's a key part of understanding how and why he felt optimistic. And again, as you said, with our current generation, one reason why I, you know, that I'm a professor at University of Florida and like history is I want to give our students some hope. You know, I wanted them to know our country has come through worse times before. We've gotten through hard times before. Don't lose faith in our country. Don't lose faith in our values, because they have proven the test of time.
That's right. You know, it's a good segue for us, because I want you to talk about in your book, though, how Reagan comes in. You know, there's a lot of people in the establishment who's worried that he's sort of a cowboy with his finger on the trigger and that he's going to push us closer to nuclear war. But let's talk about this amazing journey, this trajectory where Reagan comes in, you know, giving strong speeches against the Soviet Union, using, you could argue, bellicose language, right?
Yeah. Though the empire is pretty strong. Yeah.
Pretty strong. Ash heap of history, you know, building up missiles, his whole plan. But how this sort of Reagan national security apparatus and idea, right, becomes really a great diplomatic triumph, you know, and how Reagan, you know, does in many ways his own, like, Nixon goes to China thing, where he's able to really transform, you know, the way that statecraft could be executed, from being somebody who could hold forth with your values, but also know, look, nobody wants to be blown up by a nuclear weapon. Neither, that's what mutually assured destruction was. Yeah. But also, let's, you know, let's put our knee on the neck of the enemy while also hopefully liberating the enemy from this tyrannical system they live under. I mean, there's something amazing about those nuances. Can we talk about that?
Yeah, sure. And for our listeners, if you remember nothing else from our discussion today, and I hope you remember a lot of stuff, remember this about Reagan's foreign policy: is he combined pressure and outreach, right? That's really, that may sound simple, but that is the key to understanding everything that he was about. And so, and some people only want to emphasize the pressure with him, and others only want to emphasize the outreach. But for him, he was very committed to negotiating, but he wanted to negotiate from a position of strength. And so that's why, especially in his first term, he focused on, you know, a dramatic military buildup, you know, restoring our military strength, including expanding our nuclear arsenal, the rhetorical offensive, you know, call the Soviet Union the evil empire, saying that it will end up on the ash heap of history, as you mentioned. The human rights offensive, more aggressively supporting Soviet dissidents and dissidents behind the Iron Curtain to put internal pressure on the Soviet regime, all of that. But the entire time, he's also doing outreach to the Kremlin, saying, hey, I want to negotiate. We don't want a nuclear war. You know, we want to come to a peaceful resolution of our differences. But for him, he wanted to negotiate from a position of strength so that the Soviets would be, you know, more induced to make concessions and to not think that they could gain advantage over the United States. And this even came to a point with his pressure on the Soviet system to produce a reformist leader, right? You know, one reason why he recognized Gorbachev and embraced him as a reformer sooner than most other Americans, a lot were initially skeptical of him, is Reagan for several years had been pressuring the Soviet system, saying, I hope they'll produce a reformist leader that I can negotiate with. You know, Brezhnev, the original dictator when he took office, was not a reformer, not interested in negotiations. You know, then came Andropov, then came Chernyenko. Of course, Reagan has that.
They died quickly, though. They were older, got people, and then Andropov and Krashenko, they were gone.
Yeah, they totally lasted about a year in office. And Reagan had that great line. At one point, a reporter asked him, "Why won't you negotiate with a Soviet leader?" And Reagan said, "Well, I want to, but they keep dying on me." you know. but it was true in the space of.
Well, he had a great sense of humor. It's like after I think it's true. Right after Hinckley shot him, and he's, "Honey, I forgot to duck," he said to Nancy.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh yeah, yeah. Always wisecracking, even when he's almost dying. And then when he was going on the operating table in the emergency room, and they're, you know, trying to dig the bullet out of him, and he's losing consciousness, but it still says to the doctors, "I hope you're all Republicans," right? With those Soviet leaders who kept dying, even though he joked about it, it masked a deeper truth about the rot of the Soviet system, right? This system couldn't even produce a leader who could live more than a year because there are all these geriatric dictators.
Yeah.
Part of Reagan's pressure on that system was, hey, I want this system to feel so much pressure to reform that they have to turn to a reformist leader, a younger generation who's willing to negotiate, who wants to reduce the risk of nuclear war and bring this Cold War to an end. And I'm not saying that Reagan doesn't dictate to Moscow, thou shalt produce Mikhail Gorbachev. You know, that's a more complicated story than that. But because he'd been looking for a reformist leader, he recognized one in Gorbachev when he came along. He thought, finally, I've got a negotiating partner. And that's why it's a remarkable story of the relationship that they built.
Yeah. I mean, I think the other thing that I think people don't realize about Reagan is, and this is very key to your book, is he was not a pro-nuclear cowboy. Reagan was dead set on abolishing nuclear weapons. I mean, getting rid of them.
Yeah.
You know, talk about his anti-nuclear policy. Cause I think there also is I don't know if people even know that. I think they just think that, you know, Reagan was, you know, there's some revisionist histories which are, I believe, deeply incorrect. They said, well, you know, Reagan was sort of forced to be moderate by virtue of the position, even though he was this hardliner. And no, I don't think so. I think your book explains how he took, you know, what seemed like paradoxical ideas, right? And made them work. But he was never, hey, let's go nuke each other. I mean, that wasn't his stock and trade.
Oh, absolutely. And this is, again, another key to understand Reagan. He was terrified of nuclear weapons and he was terrified of nuclear war. And frankly, if we pause to think for a second, all of us should be terrified of nuclear war, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking about the annihilation of the planet, the human race here.
And there were enough missiles built up between our two countries in those years that, the Soviet stockpile.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's which you go into a lot of missile technology in this book, which is wonderful. I learned a lot. People don't realize it. It's not, oh, well, we have 40, I'm making this up. We have 400 missiles and you have 600. You don't need 400 missiles to blow the world up, you know?
And I do want to emphasize this point. This will segue to Reagan's desire to abolish all nukes, but to give our listeners a sense of the scale, at the height of the Reagan presidency in the Cold War, the Soviets had 40,000 nuclear weapons, most aimed at the United States.
Wow.
The United States, we had about probably 36,000 targeted at the Soviet Union. By comparison, today, the United States has, I think, about 1,800 nukes, and Russia has maybe 2,000, right? So that's still a lot, but 20 times as many during the Cold War. And any one of those can ruin your day.
But the Reagan-Gorbachev legacy, and I'm throwing Gorbachev in this regard, is that there was a tremendous effort placed on the key to their many summits was nuclear reduction.
Yeah. And again, you know, Reagan is terrified of nuclear war. And he also knows the possibility of an accident. What if the Soviets don't launch against us, but our radar malfunctions and says it did, and we could just, you know, stumble into a nuclear war. And so he knew that the very presence of these weapons is really destabilizing. So as I, you know, summarize it, the two things that Reagan wanted to get rid of were the Soviet Union and nuclear weapons. And he tried to do both, right? He knew that nuclear weapons were a real threat, but he also saw the Soviet Union as a real threat. So that's why his negotiations with Gorbachev were about how can we get rid of these weapons, but also eliminate the Soviet system. And they made great progress in that. You know, they signed what still is to this day the only treaty in history to abolish an entire class of nuclear weapons with the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. So this is a very consistent strain of Reagan. It also shows how unique he is, because most of his staff thought he was nuts to want to get rid of nukes. You know, his national security advisor or secretary of defense, like, Mr. President, we need these as a deterrent. And he'd say, I want to get rid of all of them.
Right. Talk also about, let's hit the rewind button for a second. You know, the way the Nixon and Ford and Carter administrations and previous administrations were sort of committed to the START treaties, you know, and that Reagan had great concerns about those arms control treaties. Talk what his, and I know there was among the right in the 1970s, or, you know, growing opposition. And by the way, Scoop Jackson too, and Pat Moynihan, and they were like, you know, those kind of Democrats, a holdover Cold War Democrats. What was Reagan's opposition to those arms treaty, control treaties, and how did what he did ultimately differ from those? Because I think it's worth a look.
Yeah, really important. And this is where Reagan is so hard to categorize, because he is a strong critic of the traditional arms control model, those treaties, from both the right and the left. So I'll unpack that here. Sure. So in the 70s, when there's the first round of these, they're called SALT, Strategic Arms Limitation Treaties, that, you know, Nixon.
SALT treaties, not START treaties.
Right, START comes later, so you weren't wrong about START.
START is the child of SALT, right?
Yes, exactly. And nuclear, you know, arms control is its own esoteric subfield. So
yes.
I've spent way too much time on it. But so Reagan's criticism of those treaties from the right was that they gave the Soviets an advantage over the United States. Essentially, if you look at the details of those treaties, they were giving the Soviets, they were allowing the Soviets to have a more potent nuclear arsenal than the United States. And so he worried, because he didn't trust the Soviet Union, that that these treaties leave the United States as vulnerable, at a strategic disadvantage. But he also criticizes them, if you might be, Will, from the left, that they were only slowing the growth of the arms race. And he said, look, if nuclear weapons are such a threat to human civilization, it's not, and we already have enough of a nuclear arsenal to destroy the world many times over, you know, destroy the whole galaxy. We're not making progress if we're only slowing the growth of it. And so he also said, if we're going to do real arms control, I want to significantly reduce our nuclear arsenals and eventually eliminate all of them. And so the sequencing is important. So when he comes into office, he first wants to, like I said, going back to pressure and outreach, he first wants to increase the strength of the American nuclear arsenal so it's a better deterrent against the Soviets, and we'll let the Soviets know, you know, you won't win in a nuclear war. But he wants to use that as leverage to then pivot and reduce nuclear arsenals and eventually eliminate all of them. And so it's a much more sophisticated strategy than his critics appreciated at the time, who from the right only focused, always trying to give up too much and eliminate nukes, or from the left, you know, always a cowboy and he's being too bellicose with nukes. And if you really took seriously everything he was doing, like I said, it's a much more complex picture and a very effective one.
Yeah, I mean, I think what Reagan did in terms of his rankling of the establishment and sort of scrambling of the ideological origins, if you will, of the Cold War, is that he was able to say, no, we're going to be tough and defeat this evil idea and see their and sow their demise, but we're also going to make sure that we are diplomatically elegant and astute and do what is good for world peace. Yeah. And if you think about that as part of his legacy, I mean, first of all, trying to balance that, a lot of challenges inherent in that. But again, as I said earlier, and your book explains, that was new. But it also suggested, which I love, a kind of, let's call it, dirty moderate approach, right? Where you could, you know, you weren't afraid of being dirty, but you knew you had to be moderate, because that's what civilization in terms of its survival depended upon.
Yeah. And as you, I'm sure, picked up from the book, you know, Reagan got all sorts of political criticism during his 8 years, but if anything, the most criticism he got, the most virulent, was from the hard right, you know, from you know, more, you know, the Jesse Helms wing of the Republican Party, who thought he was being a sellout. You know, you absolutely, you know, correctly highlighted his hope for world peace. I mean, that's why I titled the book The Peacemaker. And
yeah,
some people have said, you know, in Bowdoin, are you being cynical? Is that ironic? Are you trolling us? You know, he's a warmonger, not a peacemaker. I say, no, this is, Reagan often said, I have a desire to be a peacemaker. This is the tribute Gorbachev paid to him at his death, saying Reagan was a great peacemaker. So it's a very sincere title, because I think it captures the essence of the man, even if it's not fully appreciated.
Yeah. I want to talk and get in the weeds a little bit, though. You know, Reagan came to office, and as you mentioned earlier about the sort of weirdly domino theory spread of all these countries succumbing to communism, which, of course, our whole domino theory got us ensnared in the Vietnam quagmire and was part of the Cold War. Those that don't know the domino theory, if one country falls to communism, they all will fall. That was a sort of guiding principle. There's a lot of bullshit in there, too. But I think there is an interesting kind of truth. If there's two superpowers at each other's throats, you know, who can jockey for world power and strategic strategic superiority, you know, you find countries that would be vulnerable. But Reagan specifically set his eyes on Central America and the Northern Hemisphere and Latin America. Let's talk about that, because he saw, you know, obviously the very deeply worried when the Somoza dictatorship in Nicaragua fell, because the left-wing Sandinistas were going to come in, and they're again a Marxist redoubt, right? And was that El Salvador or Nicaragua, actually? Was Somoza?
Yeah, Somoza was Nicaragua. You're correct.
Nicaragua.
Yeah. And then there was the right-wing military government in El Salvador fighting.
And that, which you also talked about. There's not a lot, enough talk, because, you know, Latin America is always in the news. Now, you know, we've had the Milei in Argentina, and we had Bolsonaro, and not that these countries were necessarily part of what's going on here. But generally, you know, Central America and all these places played a key role in Reagan's Cold War policy. Let's unpack it.
Yeah, sure. And again, this is one of the most controversial aspects of his legacy, and I try to give a balanced account in the book, but just, I think, some important background for our listeners.
Also, Iran-Contra was part of this ultimately, so that's why I bring
it up. This also leads directly to the worst scandal of his presidency, which almost, you know, brings him down. So I start with this, is remember that Reagan was the two-term governor of California, a border state. Right. And so during his time as governor of California, Reagan developed a really deep affinity for Mexico. And when you look at Reagan's announcement of his presidential campaign in 1979, most of the speech is about domestic policy. He has a short section on foreign policy, and he barely even mentions the Soviet Union in the foreign policy section. Instead, he talks about his vision for the Western Hemisphere, and he even calls for a North American Free Trade Accord. He becomes the first president to call for what becomes NAFTA, you know, Canada, the United States, and Mexico. Once he's elected, but before he's sworn in, so during the transition time, he visits one country, Mexico. I'm laying that groundwork in terms of this is a president very committed to the U.S. role in the Western Hemisphere and wants to build meaningful partnerships in the Western Hemisphere, but is also very worried about communist inroads in the Western Hemisphere. Of course, after the Cuban Revolution in 1959, communism had kind of stalled out in the Western Hemisphere. But then with the Nicaraguan Revolution, as you mentioned, in 1979, there's a real worry. Is this another wave of Latin American countries falling to communism? And the Soviets and the Cubans were sponsoring a number of these communist insurgencies. And so Reagan wanted to counter that, but then he has another legacy he has to be mindful of, which is Vietnam. And the big lesson for him from Vietnam is don't send large numbers of American ground troops into, you know, a quagmire civil war, right? An unwinnable civil war. And so that's why he develops what becomes the Reagan Doctrine of, we won't send American troops to places. They may be seen as imperialistic. They, you know, they may not be an effective fighting force, but let's support other governments or other forces who want to fight for their own freedom. And so it's a defensible, even an effective doctrine overall, but it sometimes meant some moral compromises, you know, supporting some pretty unsavory and brutal either dictatorships or insurgent forces, and also meant he just stumbled into some, you know, a very problematic history of American intervention in the Western Hemisphere. And so there were no good options in Central America. I think it needs to be said, right? That's, you know, something about foreign policy is rarely are there good choices. It's more like pick among your bad choices here. But for him, it started with being very concerned to prevent any further communist inroads in Central America. But there's also the more positive vision of how can we build a better partnership between the United States and our Southern Hemisphere neighbors through free trade, through support for democratic transitions, through immigration reform. You know, he's, of course, a big supporter of immigration reform, which he also sees as part of his partnership with South and Central America.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's, you know, geopolitics. You're an expert, I'm not, but as a student of politics for many years, you know, it's like the idea, though, and I even in retrospect, Iran-Contra notwithstanding, that, you know, trying to sort of thwart, even if it meant you know, weaponry or aid of the spread of communism in that area had a value, because, you know, if you sum up geopolitics, right, yes, we don't want the governments who are satellites of the Soviet Union in power. And yes, that might mean that we are backing assholes, but let's put it bluntly, there are assholes. There's some like the Shah in Iran and Guatemala. Yeah. I'm not here supporting coups. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying though that, you know, sometimes getting rid of, and I said this to you before the show, relates to Reagan's very forceful envoy, Jean Kirkpatrick, mm-hmm. in his first term at the United Nations, you know, believing, and she wrote extensively about this in her own scholarly way, that, you know, that you could kind of work with a right-wing dictatorship if you needed to, than you could a left-wing authoritarian regime, because the left-wing authoritarian regime had, let's say, less of a penchant toward democracy because they were often hemmed in, funded, or controlled by communist governments, or especially the USSR, you know. And so, yes, we don't love dictators anywhere, but you know, authoritarianism would be an end result of it either way. And who could we deal with in a way that would be better for our interests? And I don't think there's anything in on the global stage, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, where that doesn't come into account or into your thinking. I mean, there's no bad, there's no good option. So you take the least bad option. Sometimes there's a good option, but if it's two bad options, you're not going to go with the people who are supported and financed by your mortal enemy. I mean, that doesn't make any sense. So,
I think you frame it really well there. And, you know, I think two key points for understanding Reagan's Central America policies and the challenges he had is, one, you know, it's now very clear, you know, we now have, you know, abundant archival evidence that the Kremlin and the Soviet Union was pouring massive amounts of resources into Central America to support the spread of communism, right? You know, a couple of years, the Soviets were providing $1 billion a year in support for the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. The U.S. was giving maybe $50 million a year. So in that sense, Soviet efforts to control, take over, extend influence in Central America were real. But the other thing to appreciate is, over time, especially in his second term, and here Reagan's Secretary of State George Shultz also gets a lot of credit.
Yeah.
Reagan genuinely supported democratic transitions. He did want to see these military governments transition out of power. He knew they were being too brutal to their own people. And so El Salvador, Argentina, Brazil, Chile with Pinochet all do undergo peaceful democratic transitions during his second term, you know, with Reagan's strong support. So in that sense, you know, the results speak for themselves.
Right, which justifies what I'm saying. If you can achieve that, right? It doesn't mean you're going to achieve it every time. Go into a little bit of why you think that Reagan risked so much for that Iran-Contra idea. I mean, we obviously, you make a good point. You know, the Soviets are putting $1 billion to the Sandinistas, and I know it was the focal point, but, you know, why do you think that kind of became, unfortunately, a hill for him to sort of lose his moorings on?
Yeah, I'll try to do this quickly and simply, but as you know, it's a very complicated story.
Yes.
Yeah, but I'll try to give the highlights here. And the first one is, even though we rightly, to summarize, call it the Iran-Contra scandal, there are two mostly separate pieces of it, the Iran part and the Contra part. It's all each of briefly, you know, the Iran part is, you know, Iranian sponsored terrorist groups had taken a number of Americans hostage, primarily in Lebanon, but, you know, supported from Tehran. And Reagan was just very personally seized with the plight of the hostages, right? He met with their families. He's very empathetic on a personal level. He's just, you know, horribly grieved at what the suffering they're going through. And he just thinks he wants to do anything to get them back. And he also, even though he's, you know, overall a more assertive president, he was a negotiator, and he still had some hopes that even though Iran had become more militant and anti-American after the 1979 revolution, maybe we can bring Iran back to the fold. Maybe we can support some moderates there. And so that's why he, in violation of the law, authorizes selling arms to Iran in exchange for them releasing hostages. And it doesn't really work. You know, they don't release many hostages, and even when they do, they take more, right? It's just, you know, it's a moral hazard. So it's a debacle, and he bears full responsibility for that. The other wrinkle is he wanted to support the anti-communist Contras in Nicaragua, you know, fighting against the the Soviet-backed, you know, communist dictatorship of the Sandinistas, and Congress had cut off funding for the Contras. They didn't think it was a worthy fight. And this is where I think the best evidence is that even though Reagan wanted to support the Contras, he was not very attentive to the details. And I don't think he knew that some of his staff were taking money from selling arms to Iran for the hostages and diverted it to the Contras. Now, Reagan ultimately is still responsible, right? You know, like Harry Truman said, for every president, the buck stops here. You know, if you're the commander in chief, you're ultimately responsible. But Reagan, even though he wanted support for the Contras, I don't think he knew about those details, even though he ultimately bore responsibility. But then once the scandal breaks, you know, you've got multiple laws broken against, you know, providing funding to the Contras, against selling arms to Iran. You have Reagan exposed as a president who didn't know some of the details of what was going on, and what he did know, he had made some bad decisions on, and he had lied to the American people about that too. And it's a real breach of trust, because over time, the great communicator, people thought, he'll talk straight with us, I can trust this guy, and when they realize, well, he's been lying to us about this. And so there's the political crisis, but there's also the larger crisis of confidence. And so it's definitely the lowest point of his presidency. It very, you know, he very nearly gets impeached. It nearly brings him down.
Yeah. I wanted, though, to talk about something that Reagan did also, I think, that gave moral credibility to his way of thinking, was his support of dissidents.
Yes.
You know, very important. Before I let you speak, I always like to tell listeners here, and they know, you know, one of the things, and maybe it's because I'm a kid of the Cold War. I'm also a moderate. I also am a free marketeer. And I know that any tyranny is evil, and that communism and all of its evils and its millions dead should never be forgotten. You know, what was done in the name of trying to create utopias everywhere that can't be created, and that writers, artists, thinkers, leaders, refuseniks, you know, pick your word, the Polish Solidarity Movement, all this stuff, Vaclav Havel in Czechoslovakia, you know, all these different groups who were fomenting and doing their best to be free. You know, Reagan had a great and deep abiding sympathy for them and believed in them. Talk about why you think Reagan really appreciated dissidents and what he did and what his administration did to try to help them.
Yeah, no, very, again, another very important part of his story. So I appreciate you bringing this up.
Sure.
Reagan, there were a number of different imperatives and values that flow into Reagan's very strong support for dissidents. It's not incidental. It's central to his Cold War policy. Part of it is he's a very intuitive person. He always wants to understand kind of individual human experiences of anything that's going on. And so for him, Soviet oppression was not just an abstraction. It's not just a number of statistics about this many hundreds of thousands of people dead or this many millions imprisoned. He wanted to know about the individual cases. And so he would follow very closely the plight of individual prisoners of conscience or dissidents. But the second is because he believes so much in the value of freedom, he really admired anyone who would have the courage to stand up against a totalitarian government. And he saw it as a real sign of weakness and brittleness of any government that would invest so much in oppressing and controlling and imprisoning its people and not allowing dissident voices. He saw that as a real vulnerability. He realized, well, the Kremlin is actually afraid of its own citizens. How can you tell that? Because it won't allow them freedom, right? It won't allow them to vote. It won't allow them to you know, criticize their government or have a free press or any of those things. And so, since he's very attuned to, he wanted to find what are vulnerabilities in the Soviet system, he thought, all right, if the Kremlin's afraid of these dissidents, then I want to support them. If they're against the Kremlin and the Kremlin's afraid of them, then they're my people. And so that's why he invested so much in supporting, you know, Natan Sharansky, the great Soviet Jewish dissident who was imprisoned, or you know, Andrei Sakharov, or the other refuseniks, or the Siberian Pentecostals, or, you know, Christian dissidents as well. He does it from a humanitarian impulse, but also because it's a way for him to kind of bring internal pressure on the Soviet system, you know, not just from those Americans outside, but supporting its own people, and try to help turn, you know, he didn't see the Soviet people as the enemy. He saw the system as the enemy. And so he wanted the Soviet people to know, I am on your side. America is on your side. Anyone who wants to stand up for your freedom in the world, America will stand with you, and I will stand with you. And this drove the Soviets nuts. Whenever Reagan would meet with a Soviet leader, especially Gorbachev, he'd spend a lot of time saying, I want you to release these, you know, these people from prison. I'll give you the names. I'll give you a list of the prisoners. Mm-hmm. And it's very embarrassing for Gorbachev, because Gorbachev deep down knew this is not a healthy sign of a society that we're imprisoning some of our most dynamic, innovative, courageous people just because they criticize the government.
Yeah, I mean, especially Soviet Jewry, you know, and this moment we're in now. I mean, one of the things I remember so vividly, which is going to bring me to a Joe Biden thing in a second, but, you know, you had Kirkpatrick at the UN, you had Reagan's commitment to resettle Soviet refugees, you know, stuff like that, and his commitment to Israel, you know, that was all part of it. I mean, of course, as I've written about in my Substack, you know, people forget the Soviet Union created essentially the PLO. So they were the chief backers. You know, a lot of people, again, have no history. You know, we can talk about today's crisis, but remember that, you know, these two global powers, you know, Soviet Union provided material to the Syrians and the Egyptians and the Jordanians at that time. And of course, backed Arafat and all that stuff. They were the part of the whole third world bloc, and Zionism is equals racism. It has deep roots in Soviet propaganda.
Yeah. You know,
in this, again, the civilizational battle. But I say all this to say that when you speak of the Reagan doctrine, especially the idea of we aren't going to do a Vietnam style quagmire and send our troops everywhere, but ideologically, morally, from an infrastructure perspective and what have you, we're going to support our cause. I think that with Ukraine and largely really to Israel, despite his crazy left, Biden has kind of emulated the Reagan doctrine in a lot of ways, in the best sense. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I do. You know, and I'm, you know, certainly critical of Biden in a number of other ways, but absolutely on those issues, right? I mean, you know, Ukraine, you know, supporting, you know, providing, you know, weapons and economic aid to Ukraine is a page straight out of the Reagan Doctrine playbook. I mean, it is, you know, it is supporting people who are fighting for their own freedom against Kremlin aggression, right? I mean, that's, you know, if you want to put it in one sentence.
Sure.
And I've been, you know, grieved to see the Republican Party not more supportive on that front too. It's certainly an abandonment of the Reagan legacy.
Do you, when you see the Republican Party, you know, kind of tilting back toward isolationism, you know, and in many ways the darker, not even just a Robert Taft pre-World War II thing, but kind of a Father Coughlin-y dark, you know, we're going to erect barriers like they're living in like this is 1890 or something crazy. Again, you worked in the George W. Bush administration, right? You know, clearly for, again, incredibly non-isolationist, you know, true internationalist for sometimes for the worse, but that was part of the idea, you know, being bold on the world stage. I mean, that Trump could come in and do that and sort of, again, throw away any remnant of the Reagan doctrine. Well, what do you attribute that to? What are your thoughts on that from a contemporary perspective?
Yeah, again, I'm very disturbed by it. I'm very grieved by it. I've you know written and spoken a lot against this. I also step back and try to understand it, and I think, you know, it is part of some of the cycles of history. You mentioned some of these earlier antecedents. You know, it does feel like a recurrence of a 1930s moment, or maybe a little later, some of the Taftite isolation. So in that sense, these aren't completely new strains. You had it in the early 1990s with the Pat Buchanan candidacy too. Right?
Yeah.
You know, almost explicitly anti-Semitic in his opposition to Israel, and then just, you know, a come home America mentality on the world stage, and so. So these things aren't completely new, but what has been new and disturbing is, you know, having a president, a presidential candidate in Trump who exemplifies these and has helped spread these ideas. They're not off at the margins anymore. But you know, this was a concern Reagan had in his own day. I mean, one of his, you know, he had many great speeches, but one of my favorites is the Boys of Point Du Hoc, right? You know, Peggy Noonan, right? It's, you know, the 40th anniversary of the D-Day landings at Normandy. I still tear up every time I watch the video of it. Encourage all your listeners to. It's only about 15 minutes on YouTube.
These were the boys of Point Du Hoc.
Yeah, that's right. So these are the men who freed the continent. A big part of the speech is a World War II tribute, and that's powerful. But towards the end, Reagan brings it back to the present day context, and he talks about the importance of standing fast with our allies against tyranny, whether it was Nazi tyranny or now Soviet tyranny, and then even warns against isolationism. He said, "We've learned this hard truth from two world wars: the isolationism never was and never is an effective response against tyranny, that we station our troops over here, we defend freedom over here so that it doesn't get threatened at home. And so, again, this goes back to him being a student of history, and he very much warned against these recurring trends. And he saw it in his own party some in the 1980s, and it's certainly back with us today. But, that's right.
Reagan triumphalist moments. Mm-hmm. It's 1987, the tear down this wall speech, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. Another one that so deeply moving. How did that speech factor into the period of time? Because a year prior he'd been at Reykjavik, right? Mm-hmm. He was going through a variety of summits and meetings and constant communication with Kremlin and Gorbachev at that time. Mm-hmm. How did that factor in, and what did that signal to Moscow?
Yes. So, and I'm glad you'd asked me about Iran-Contra earlier, because that speech comes right after the Iran-Contra scandal. And it's a great example, I think, of Reagan getting his mojo back, to put it colloquially, right? He's had a crisis of confidence and loss of trust in the American people because of the scandal. Moscow has been looking at him thinking, oh, maybe this guy isn't such an effective president. Maybe we can get the upper hand. And so when he then travels to Berlin and stands, there at the Brandenburg Gate. And the other thing to remember is, coming out of Reykjavik, he had been building this friendship with Gorbachev. He had extended the hand of outreach. They were talking about reducing nuclear weapons. But as I mentioned earlier, Reagan is always combining pressure and outreach. And with the Berlin Wall, that to him just symbolized Soviet oppression, because it was not built to keep people out of East Berlin. It was built to keep them imprisoned within, right?
Of course.
And it wasn't the Germans who had built the Berlin Wall. It was the Soviets who had built it. Yeah. So it's a symbol of oppression in a communist society imprisoning its own people, and of Soviet imperialism, that they're doing this in another country. And he knew that just as the Soviets had built the wall, the Soviets would have the authority to tear it down. And so that's why those words are so important. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. It doesn't say Mr. Honecker, the East German leader. It says Mr. Gorbachev, tear it down. And so it's Reagan's way of regaining the initiative in the Cold War, showing Iran-Contra may have hurt me, but I'm down, but I'm not out. I'm coming back. I'm still going to put pressure on Gorbachev. And it's also Reagan's message to the people of East Germany, and certainly of East Berlin. You want the wall taken down. You now have an American president who will speak the truth about it and who will call for it. Of course, ultimately, it is those people of East Germany who tear down the wall 2.5 years later.
Yeah. Before we finish, what would you say was Reagan's biggest folly? If you had to level, and your book is very honest about this, because mm-hmm. this is not a book without acknowledging or pointing out the blemishes of the Reagan administration. Mm-hmm. Besides Iran-Contra, where do you think Reagan fell short? Where do you think part of his legacy is somewhat, not to say besmirched, but is somewhat more spotty than it might otherwise be, specifically in the area of foreign policy?
Yeah, I'll mention a couple. One builds off Iran-Contra, but overall his Middle Eastern legacy was not a great one, right? I mean, the Iran-Iraq war was going on at the time. He provided, out of realpolitik motives, a lot of support to Iraq, who years later we have to go to war against in the Persian Gulf War.
But also sold arms to Iran to get.
Yeah, he sold arms to Iran too. So it's just kind of incoherent, right? So the Middle Eastern policy there, you can't point to a lot of successes. It was tough. It was a bit of a mess, but he made a share of mistakes. Another one, I know you said primarily foreign policy, but the budget deficits and then the growing national debt. Now, it's not entirely his fault. Congress has the power of the purse. The Democrats in Congress in particular were on a spending binge. But Reagan was such an effective president and leader in so many other areas, and could have his way with Congress in so many other areas, that he really failed on that one. And he himself would have said that was one of his biggest regrets. And that has foreign policy implications, and that insofar as it is a drag on the American economy, or a vulnerability from all of our foreign indebtedness, it's also a foreign policy vulnerability.
Yeah. I mean, I think, though, your book in the epilogue, to close out, speaking of the way Reagan could still, take stock of what had been done that was good, because that was sort of crucial to his not just optimistic nature, but his belief in America, you know, something that he radiated so sincerely that we all could feel in a way that, you know, if the presidency is a bully pulpit, if the presidency is very, very, very tied into and bound to the idea of the bully pulpit, right? Of using that as an inspirational instrument, no one perfected it like Reagan. I mean, you know what I mean? Because, and that's important, you know, the way the president communicates. I mean, one of the things, before we finish, you know, you saw Joe Biden seemingly spring to life in this last State of the Union address, strong and confident. That's what I think people want. You can agree or disagree with the policies, and I do, but you want to hear somebody stand up for what it is they're proposing, their values over that. But, you know, in that farewell address, which you write about, January 11th, 1989, you know, he always, as you put it, he spoke more of his country than himself. And you write, he invoked a favorite image, America as a shining city on a hill, and continued, if there had to be city walls, the walls had doors, and the doors were open to anyone with the will and the heart to get here. He closed with his hope. And how stands this city on this winter night? More prosperous, more secure, and happier than it was 8 years ago. But more than that, after 200 years, two centuries, she still stands strong and true on the granite ridge, and her glow has held steady no matter what storm. And she's still a beacon, still a magnet for all who must have freedom, for all the pilgrims from all the lost places who are hurtling through the darkness toward home.
Amen.
Tough not to get. I hope that everybody hears those words. It gets me choked up, you know, when you see the evils of Trumpism and all the crap we're going through, and that's what we're fighting for. I normally don't get worked up like that, but man, that was good. It was good. So those Peggy Noonan's words?
Yeah, those were. Although I will say Reagan had such a strong hand in his own speeches, and so he would work closely with, you know, speechwriters like her and Tony Dolan, in other words, but a lot of it are his own words too. So he wasn't just reading a script someone else prepared. He was reading a script that he helped write himself.
Yeah. So for all those hurling toward darkness, toward home, you know, God bless you. And please, you know, may America continue to be the shining city on a hill. You know, I still think it is. I know you do. And it's up to all of us. And this podcast was created as a pro-democracy outlet. And that's what we do here every day. So your book is a wonderful portal into that and why it matters and how the events have shaped us. And then some. The book is The Peacemaker, Ronald Reagan, the Cold War, and the World on the Brink. I know you go by Will, but your book name is William N. Bowden. And I want to thank you. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll have you back and talk more. And I'm excited to see what you do next.
Well, thanks, Adam. I'm very grateful.
Thank you. All right, folks, as always, stay dirty, stay moderate, stay safe.